I have learned so much from Parker already, and I am thrilled that you are going to get a chance to hear this talk again. The last time we did it, it was a big success. And Cliff Brothers is our composer on Pelleas and Melisande and has worked with the Cutting Ball Theater for many years on many productions. And I think you and Rob were estimating maybe 20 or more?
I think it was 15, maybe.
15? Okay, so maybe. So
lost count.
Productions. Too many to count. And is a good friend. So without further ado, Parker and Cliff.
Thank you very much. So in a few minutes, we are all going to be in the audience together for a performance of a new translation of Maurice Maeterlinck's inspiring and hugely influential late 19th century play, Pelleas et Mélisande. So where did the play come from, and why was it inspiring, and how was it influential? Pelleas et Mélisande, as many of you know already, is the story of a forbidden love between a prince, Pelleas, and a beautiful young woman named Mélisande, who has been discovered by his older half-brother, Golo, by the edge of a spring. And she seems to have come from nowhere and has a surreal, almost mythical quality to her. And over the course of the play, in 15 short scenes of often exquisite sexual tension, Pelleas and Mélisande fall in love. And although that love is never consummated, by play's end, Pelleas has been killed by his jealous brother, and the delicate Mélisande has died of a broken heart. Or is it from the tiny wound that she's also suffered? It isn't completely clear, like so many things in Pelleas et Mélisande. But what we do know with certainty is that when the play was premiered in Paris on May 17th, 1893, it set creative Europe on its ear. And for the next 10 to 15 years, many of the best composers of orchestral music in France and elsewhere were inspired to write music for Pelleas et Mélisande. While we're talking about the play's premiere in Paris, by the way, I should add that I think it's no coincidence that the most prominent composer of music for Pelleas we'll discuss this afternoon, Claude Debussy, was in attendance. More on Debussy in just a minute. So I want to introduce you to four or five pieces today, or for the music lovers among you, perhaps to reintroduce. So in the best tradition of classical music, let's start with an overture. Wagner's 1865 masterwork, Tristan und Isolde, also about noble, forbidden love and death, changed music forever with its strange, new, yearning dissonances. Was Tristan in any way a model for Pelleas, which followed 30 years later? What we can know with certainty was that the spirit of Tristan, with its anguished, overripe, forbidden qualities, was in the air, and that a young Debussy had made a trip to Bayreuth to hear the opera. So I think it's fair to view Pelleas as in some way a possibly French Tristan. Now, the first composer inspired by Pelleas and Mélisande we're going to listen to today was a Frenchman, the enormously gifted Gabriel Fauré. The play was being produced in London at the Prince of Wales Theatre in 1898, and Fauré was commissioned on short notice to write the incidental music. So although given very little time, he complied with a marvelous 19-minute, 5-minute work, his Opus 80. Because Fauré's Pelleas has a big tune many of you may know already, let's listen. This is the Sicilienne. Familiar? composer to take up Pelléas was Jean Sibelius, the great Finnish master. His Opus 46 is a 9-movement set of incidental music for a production of the play produced at the Swedish Theater in Helsinki in 1905, 7 years after the Forêt. Interestingly, the structure is almost identical to that of the Forêt. There is introductory music about Mélisande and music about her death. And this, in one important scene in the play, Mélisande is at her spinning wheel. So let's listen to what Sibelius does with this, both because he captures her spinning so perfectly and because the music is so distinctly Sibelian. Can you hear the spinning? And the strings? Those harmonies could come from no one in the world but John Sibelius, a heartbreaking figure in classical music, because some 30 years before the end of his life, either because of exhaustion or severe alcoholism, loss of the muse, or some other cause, stopped his composing completely and never issued another work, while the whole world waited with never-to-be-fulfilled hopes. And I think it's interesting, and perhaps not a coincidence, that at the same time he wrote this, Sibelius wrote the music for his only opera, called, interestingly, The Maiden in the Tower. We now turn to two large-scale, immensely beautiful musical works inspired by the play. First, to Arnold Schoenberg. Schoenberg, who lived from 1874 to 1951, was, as many of you know, the creator of a new method of composition in the early part of the 20th century called the 12-tone system, or serialism, which utilized all 12 tones in the scale in rows or series. He had a great number of students over the years, first in Vienna and then in Berlin, and later in Los Angeles at UCLA. His two principal disciples were Alban Berg, the composer of the operas Lulu and Wozzeck, and Anton Webern, a particular favorite of mine, and not just because we share a birthday, but who wrote finely honed miniatures of exquisite detail, making important use of silence that was to have a very important impact on composers in the second half of the 20th century in the United States, such as John Cage. But our work for consideration today, Pelléas and Mélisande, his Opus 5 is from another earlier period in Schoenberg's life, when he was in his late 20s and his career was just starting to take off down a very bumpy runway. The original idea to take on the work came to Schoenberg from none other than Richard Strauss, a leader of the German avant-garde at that time, and a very important composer, about 10 years Schoenberg's senior. Strauss suggested it would make a very good idea for an opera. And it was a real act of generosity by Richard Strauss, who also employed the young Schoenberg with his equally young wife and 3-month baby at home as a copyist. Years later, of course, these two masters had grown far apart. In 1913, Strauss wrote to Alma Mahler about Schoenberg and his 12-tone system, quote, "Only a psychiatrist can help poor Schoenberg now. He would be better off shoveling snow instead of scribbling music on paper." The following year, Schoenberg, asked to say something in honor of Strauss's 50th birthday, was equally uncharitable, noting, quote, "He is no longer of the slightest artistic interest to me, and whatever I may have once learned from him, I am thankful to say I misunderstood." In any event, the musical result was Arnold Schoenberg's first orchestral effort, and what an effort! A massive tone poem of Richard Strauss-sized girth and scored for an orchestra of 64 strings, 17 woodwinds, 18 brass, and 2 harps. That's a 101-piece orchestra, which is huge. The work lasts for over 40 minutes and is filled with scenes of extraordinary, aching beauty, just like the play. And just like the play, one isn't always exactly sure of the ground one is on in Schoenberg's Peleus. We begin just where the play does, in the forest. And Schoenberg's forest is dark. English horn, bass clarinet, three bassoons and contrabassoon, violas, celli, and bass. And if you're interested, any of you are musical, I have the score here. And you can follow along with this, or we can take a look at it after the lecture. But the music, short music is right here. Schoenberg wastes little time showing the listener that this story isn't going to have a traditional happy ending. In the opening, we also hear the fate theme, a four-note cry in the clarinet. Let's listen. Later, Melisande is pictured at the fountain with Peleus, playing with her wedding ring given to her by Golod when, by accident, it falls into the water. Several of the play's most important scenes, including Peleus and Golod's terrifying descent into the castle's gloomy underground vaults. Let's listen with an ear to the glissandi, which means sliding, by the two trombones as down, down, down they go under the house. Now, one of the play's most enduring and famous images, and a one that is done, I think, particularly effectively here in the Cutting Ball production, is the famous window scene duet in which Melisande leans out of the window and her long hair wraps around Peleus below. It's intensely erotic and also has some of the tone poem's best music. 9. Schoenberg was later to say of his first work, quote, "It was around 1900 when Maurice Maeterlinck fascinated composers, stimulating them to create music to his dramatic poems. What attracted all was his art of dramatizing eternal problems of humanity in the form of fairy tales, lending them timelessness without adhering to imitation of the ancient styles. Well, I've saved... Good, thank you. Right on schedule. I've saved the best for last. As I'm sure you know already, Claude Debussy was one of the greatest composers of all time, and perhaps the greatest of all French composers. He was both born and died during German invasions of France, and in fact, he died and was buried during the German shelling of Paris in 1918. So perhaps it's not a coincidence that he was a standard bearer for the cause of independence of French music against the stylistic domination of the Austrians and the Germans. Although the opera was premiered in Paris on April 30th, 1902, when Debussy was 40, he had been working on it for almost 10 years, so simultaneously with the Paris premiere, and thus it can be said that Pelléas and Mélisande was a breakthrough work, though Debussy had previously written such important works as the Trois Nocturnes and the Prélude à l'après-midi d'un Faune. I think the best way to begin to appreciate Pelléas and Mélisande is to listen to an extended stretch. So let's start the music. This is Act Two, Scene One, the beginning, and we're back at the fountain. I think the orchestra is more important in some ways than the singer, because the orchestra tells the story. The singers don't really have melodies so much. It seems as though they're embroidering on top of the orchestra and adding coloristic effects. I often come here around noon. It's hot today. Let's be in the shade of the trees. The water is so clear. It's as cool as winter. This is an old abandoned well. It seems to work miracles. It's opened the eyes of the blind. They still call it blind man's well. Doesn't it open the eyes of the blind anymore? Since the king is almost blind himself, people don't come here any longer. How solitary it is, she says. It's extraordinarily quiet. You can almost hear the water sleeping. See the bottom of the water, she says. No one's ever seen it. Don't lean over like that, he says. Mind you don't slip. Oh, your hair, he says, your hair. I hope to have opened your ears a little bit this afternoon and showed you very different ways that Maeterlinck inspired composers in Europe and Scandinavia in the 20 years after the play was written. And I look forward to seeing you in the theater and in the lobby after the lecture if you'd like to come and ask questions. But now, for the best part of my Cutting Balls lecture, which is we're going to talk to today's composer, Cliff Carruthers, who has written a score for the production that we're going to be seeing today. So, first of all, Cliff, why don't you tell us all how you became involved with Cutting Ball Theater, and maybe a little bit about work you've done in the past, and how it all started.
Well, Rob and I have been working together for about 10 years now. We've done, as we talked about earlier, over a dozen shows over the years, so we've become really fast collaborators. And Rob is the first person ever to hire me based on something he heard. So I'll always, we'll always have a very close relationship. My path into sound design came through electronic music. I actually started out, I grew up playing music, but when I was in college, I taught myself how to improvise and sort of how to express myself in that way. And over the years, I got more involved in computers, and that led to an interest in electronic music. So for me, it's the composition process has a lot to calls on different areas of that thought process. So to set up environments in which I can improvise and create. And create pieces of music using electronic sources. So.
Okay, there's a lot of material there. So talk a little bit to us about what are particular challenges or what's particularly inspiring about writing music for a theatrical production?
Well, you really get a chance to bring a play to life in a way that I think other design mediums aren't really capable of. You know, I think the thing that music and sound design really has in common with acting and live performance is that it happens in time with the actors. So it's so you set things up in such a way that you can react to and augment what's happening on stage, and also kind of nudge the play in different directions. I feel like it's a very powerful way of augmenting a play and leading us into places we want to go. So. Mm.
And building the mood, it's like a second set. Like I was saying in my lecture a little bit, it's almost like a second set of scenery or something. It's mm-hmm. it's another.
And it's something that tends to enter, not so probably not these folks because they're you're all music lovers here, but it tends to enter people on a subconscious level. And they're affected by it without necessarily knowing that they are, which is fascinating and frustrating at the same time.
Speaking of being affected, I have to ask this, and I don't think I asked it last time. Did you feel in any way influence or any pressure because of all the composers before you who?
Absolutely, and I know most of these pieces very well. I wasn't too familiar with the Schoenberg before we talked, being a music lover, I've known all those pieces, but over the past year or so, I didn't want to hear those pieces. I didn't want to have any. I didn't want to feel that pressure, and I also didn't want to. I wanted to try and make something that was my own and not feel like I was being too influenced by, the great masters of the past. So
let's talk about your own music now. Now, talk about how talk about the genius of the idea. Talk about a scene, perhaps, that was particularly powerful to you, and what the inspiration was, how the music got put down on the page. Anything that will take a bit of your inspiration and bring it to life.
Well, I mean, my way into the play was through the water imagery. If you know the play, it's sprinkled throughout the play. These references to water and what that means in a symbolist play, you know, the sort of the source of life and the source of all things, really. So you know, when you hear the play, there's a lot of water sounds, actual water recordings, and what I, you know, we talked about this last time. What I consider to kind of be the theme of the play is a kind of repeating, flowing riff that I actually took the sound of a droplet of water and slowed it down and kind of traced a melody onto that sound.
Did you all follow that?
Probably.
Yeah. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about. I mean, if you spread that idea out a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, well, a popular example of this would be like Steve Reich's Different Trains, where he took the voices of Holocaust survivors and traced melodies onto their voices and created the music that way. So that's the genius of the idea, I guess.
And were there any scenes? I know this one I didn't ask you before, so this is the first time you've heard this question. But were there scenes that you found particularly inspiring that took you in a different direction musically than you were going in other parts of the score? Or?
I'd say the two big contrasting scenes, you know, the scene where you were talking about earlier, where Melisande's her hair falls out of the tower. It's just the two actors we have in this play are just their chemistry is amazing and just a very touching there's eroticism there, but it's all there's also just a longing and it's just very inspiring to me. I don't quite know how to encapsulate that. But.
It is. It's both very sexual and not at all.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of saying it. And I think also, you know, the scenes where we go under the castle and scenes in these caves, just for my part, I was able to bring in some really different sonic textures and ideas and call on different aspects of electronic music and that sort of thing. So just the contrast there is interesting to me.
When you get an idea, do you work at a keyboard or is it all up in here? How does the sound come from here to our ears?
Well, I use a lot of different. I mean, there's a lot of different tools in the toolkit, but I do use a keyboard for the straight up melody, melodic pieces that you'll hear. Those are keyboard and computer based. The sounds that the keyboard is triggering. Some of those are like we described the sound of the there's a sound of a water droplet that I've kind of turned into a sample sound. But some of the sounds are purely electronic. They're generated using some of them with a program called C Sound. Basically, it's just pure synthesis. You're building sounds from scratch. And you can create some very unearthly, inhuman, if that's a word, sounds that I think allow you to push the boundaries in some interesting ways.
Now I want to go back to something we began discussing a minute ago. Now you have all this music in your head, and presumably quite a bit on paper or in your computer, but now here you are, and you're on Taylor Street, and you're working with Rob, and how do you take that score and match it to the action on the stage?
Well, that's one big difference, you know, a huge difference between, you know, working with an orchestra and working with recorded sounds. I mean, you're trying to, I often refer to it as the idea of massaging concrete. you're you set things up in layers so that you can have things, you can set things up so that they happen on an actor's line, on a particular action on stage, and you set things up in such a way that they can be layered and layers can come in and out and still feel very musical. So that while the different layers, the different aspects of the sound are set, the implementation of them is very live and slightly different from show to show. And that allows it to that allows the sounds to breathe with the actors. You know, otherwise you'd be saying, okay, actors, here's a CD, go out and act exactly to it, you know, and don't change anything, don't do anything different, you know. So it's,
which would feel pretty dry and
no fun,
human, and it wouldn't work.
And no fun for the actors or anyone else, really. So,
okay. I think that's it. So we'd love though to carry on the conversation if you'd like to out in the lobby until the production starts at 2. Thank you all for coming. It was a great pleasure for us to speak for you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for your help. I really appreciate it.